So as far as my personal experience goes, you know, I grew up in Mumbai, India, and my earliest memories are of the extreme poverty and deprivation, child malnutrition, and the caste and sexual violence that exists there. And seeing that all of that exists alongside extreme wealth consolidated by, you know, in the hands of the few. And so from my very childhood onwards, I can't say that I was a Marxist in my childhood because I didn't know about such a thing until I met Marxists in Seattle. But I knew just from a logical standpoint that the world clearly has enough wealth and technological capability to completely eliminate this kind of suffering. And yet it exists, which to me, my conclusion from that was obviously it's not something inevitable to the human condition, but clearly is a product of the system that we have. So I carried that understanding with me everywhere, you know, as I went through my life, you know, in school and college, primarily being around apolitical people and mostly doing mathematics, you know, going to engineering school. And then when I came to the U.S., it was quite stunning for me to see poverty exist here too, because I, you know, my naive, I guess, understanding was that it's the wealthiest country in the world. It should have the best mass transit of anywhere. It should have stunning social services and no poverty, no homelessness. But my observation was to the contrary, and that really was an additional step in my understanding of, you know, the state of the world. And it was just when I was looking around for organizations to get involved in that I was, I was tuned into the NADER campaign in 2008, and then in 2009, I listened to a speech by a member of Socialist Alternative, and at that very moment, I knew that was what I was looking for. That was the analysis I was looking for, and I've never looked back since then. And as far as the miracle, as you said, of having an open socialist elected in city council in Seattle and then using that to build a $15 campaign, which is on the verge of a historic victory, all of that is the product not just of me personally. Obviously, I've been a significant part of it, but our electoral campaign itself was not something that I decided to do on an individual basis. And I think that is an important lesson that I would like to share with everybody on the left who's looking to understanding how is it that we can build an independent challenge to the Democrats, and how is it that we can build mass movements that can win substantial reforms while calling for systemic change. And that lesson is that we need to break from careerist politicians and that idea of politics, you know, that sort of the bourgeois politics where political campaigns are primarily in the service of enriching individual careers, where the good of humanity, the fight for the working class, is always sacrificed for the more expedient question of, you know, well, I need to build links with this business or that business. I need to stay good with this or that wealthy person. And it's always rationalized on that basis. And so just, you know, having well-meaning people who engage in Democratic Party politics is not the answer, because it's not good intentions of that kind, that good intentions that are always rationalized away in the service of the status quo is not what we need. That is exactly what is harmful to us. And so what Socialist Alternative did in running our campaign is showed that what we need is an independent force for the working class that will challenge the Democratic Party, that will propel movements forward, and that will stand candidates in elections who are not driven by their personal gain or any desires for their personal careers, but are purely offering themselves as representatives for the interests of the working class. And so when we ran these campaigns in Socialist Alternative, the question of the candidate was a democratic decision taken by the organization. I didn't choose to run, in some ways, unfortunately for me, because I have to play this very public role, which, you know, I would not have chosen for myself. But we are a democratic organization. We voted on whether or not to run an electoral campaign. Who the candidate should be was also a democratic decision. And what the campaign platform should be was a subject of a serious discussion and analysis. That's what we need. You know, should we say $15 an hour on our campaign pamphlet? Is that going to energize a large mass of young workers? You know, those are deep political questions that have to be engaged in, and they go well beyond any one individual personality. However, we also want this campaign and the success of my election campaign to serve as an inspiration to many young people all across the country who will hopefully see this as the seed of something more to come, and that we don't want me to be the last working class candidate. We want this to be the beginning of something big.
Your success in Seattle, running as a socialist and using the $15 an hour campaign as kind of your banner, can that whole success be transplanted to other places around the country? Or is Seattle very special in terms of its culture, counterculture, the youth culture, places like Berkeley and San Francisco and Portland, the whole sort of Northwest coast may be looked at as quite different from the rest of the country. Do you think what you accomplished can work elsewhere?
Well, I have no doubt that there are many unique features in Seattle that you probably won't find in, I don't know, Houston, Texas, or somewhere like that. You know, there is a cultural distance between different places in the United States. Certainly, Seattle is decisively much more liberal and progressive. The struggle for gay rights has gained, you know, tremendous ascendancy in Seattle and in Washington State. You know, Washington State in 2012 passed Referendum 74, which upheld marriage equality, and we also passed a law that ended the criminalization of marijuana possession. And so there's no doubt that there are features that are unique to Seattle. But I would say that about any place. You know, every place has unique features. New York City has its unique features that can't be replicated in Seattle. And while those features certainly play a role, I would say that those are not the ones that drive political changes. They may play a role, but primarily what is driving political change is the same is in any class system, in any system that relies on oppression and exploitation. The social conditions engineered by that system are also the engineers of the need for political activism, because it's, you know, it's stemming from those circumstances that people live in, that people's you know, that the idea of political activism and the need to fight the system is, you know, that that seed is germinated. So we don't, you know, Seattle's progressive quality does not generate that, but what it does is it offers a space for that kind of activism. And I would say that those social conditions exist everywhere, not just in the United States, but they, you know, in all across the world. You know, capitalism is a global system, and it's by virtue of its nature, it's a global wasteland of poverty and, you know, extreme misery. At the same time that you have this hideous, you know, amassing of wealth by a few individuals. And so it's the understanding that this system does not work for us that all of the inspiration for political action comes from that. What we did differently in Seattle is not the hippie culture of Seattle, but the fact that Socialist Alternative had the vision, the analysis to recognize that there is an opening for the left to run a tremendously successful campaign and use that to build future campaigns like we've done, you know, building our success last year into the $15 struggle. That opening for the left exists everywhere in the country. And my hope is that we take our lessons from Seattle and build upon that everywhere. That's why when we launched 15 Now in January, it has really taken off. 15 Now chapters have been emerging from many different cities all around the nation. You know, we have a 15 Now organization in New York City as well. And what I would urge everybody at the Left Forum is, if you're inspired by what we've done in Seattle, then let's use that platform, use that as a pole of attraction to bring more people. I mean, there's 4,000 people at the Left Forum. We need a movement of tens of thousands in New York City in order to really shift the mood. And in fact, New York City is quite similar to Seattle in many ways, because here again, last year, we had the election, the landslide victory of Bill de Blasio. And again, you know, you see the sort of the complexity. On the one hand, Bill de Blasio is very much an establishment politician. You know, the Clintons officiated at his inaugural reception. But at the same time, the rhetoric that he had in his campaign and the support, the resounding support that he got, are reflections of people looking for alternatives. And the job of the left is to show that, you know, de Blasio will not be able to fulfill any of the promises that he may have made, because he's part of an establishment that is tied to big business. And so we need to channel all that desire for change away from the Democratic Party into independent forces.
In terms of the $15 campaign, as you said earlier, you're on the verge of an incredible success. It seems that your spark in your campaign will now come to fruition with the expected vote of the city council, and your vote included, on Monday, June 2nd, and the city of Seattle will become the first city in the country with a $15 minimum wage. So we're seeing some incredible things resulting from your campaign right now. What is it that you think can be learned by the rest of the country in terms of that $15 threshold? Do you think a critical mass was reached by what you accomplished in Seattle? And can that campaign, do you have indications there are cities around the country that are moving right now to pressure their own city officials to go for a $15 minimum wage?
Yeah, we know that you know, Chicago, for example, is making a headway towards towards that kind of demand for $15 an hour. And in fact, I would say that we're seeing the impacts of that in many ways, both directly and indirectly. And really, one really exciting example that I wanted to share with you is we haven't officially won $15 an hour in Seattle yet. But just by the energy and the excitement that our campaign has generated in Seattle, we've seen the spin-off, you know, I would say spin-off victories in other places. So there's a city called Bellingham, about an hour and a half drive north of Seattle, and the city hosts one of the major state universities, Western Washington University. And the union, the trade union that represents the custodial staff at Western, which is the WFSE, which is the Washington Federation of State Employees, which is part of AFSCME, they have been so inspired by the struggle in Seattle that they, you know, when they went into contract negotiations earlier this year, they took a look at how many of their workers are still under 15, even though the university has, you know, large state funding and their executives are paid, you know, enormously well. And what they did was, during their contract negotiations, they took all the statistics of the number of their workers who are paid so little that they are eligible for food stamps. They took that into their negotiations, and they shamed the university management into giving them 15 in their contract. I mean, this victory has already been won, even though we haven't actually won the main victory, which is in Seattle. And why did that happen? Not because they didn't know earlier that their workers are so poor that they qualify for food stamps, but
it's
because
the
they
pressure
were.
It's your victory.
It's the pressure of the victory, or the impending victory on the leadership, and it's the courage that the membership of the union gets from this to have the courage to go and demand that. And that's the kind of change we're looking for.
You know, Boeing is there in Seattle. Walmart, which actually trains its people on how to go get food stamps because they know they don't pay them enough a living wage. All the small businesses there are going to feel the pinch of that $15 an hour. And I'm just wondering if you are expecting any kind of backlash, if any threats have been made to, okay, we'll pull out of Seattle or whatever. I mean, I'm just sort of interested in the pushback that you think might occur.
The pushback has already been happening. I mean, from the moment that $15 an hour really took off in people's imagination in Seattle. They've been fighting back. You know, when we first called for $15 an hour at the beginning of our electoral campaign last year, the corporate media was not paying attention to us, and they didn't really care one way or another because it hadn't become a mainstream or a mass demand, you know. So it presented no threat to them. But it's been a phenomenal activation of consciousness in Seattle since then, because poll after poll is indicating that well over two-thirds majority, and the recent poll indicated 70% of people of Seattle believe that $15 an hour is the right kind of wage. Now, businesses, as you suggested, you know, don't support 15 because they don't want to pay 15. It's capitalism is a system of businesses run on poverty wages. I mean, that's built into the model, and so they hate every bit of it, but they are no longer able to come out and say that in any open way because it'll completely discredit them to say that in a city where there is such an enormous demand for $15 an hour. So what they do is engage in fear-mongering, you know, say that businesses will close down or we'll have to leave. But, you know, something interesting that in every city where the minimum wage was increased, and even in Washington State, the last time it was increased, they said the same things. And just from just a basic, you know, economics standpoint, I can tell you, you know, from capitalist economics, and as an economist, I can tell you that it's not easy for them, for businesses to just shut down and go. If they could, they would. And business, you know, does businesses under capitalism do figure out ways of going on, you know, a capital strike. And that happened, that's happened before, and that will happen in the future. But it's not that simple for them to do that. I mean, think about it, right? Seattle is a prime destination for many upper middle class and upper class households, and they come there because they like the vibrant culture, the city, the beauty of the Puget Sound, and so on. So when restaurants and other businesses threaten that they're going to leave, where are they going to go? You know, they came to Seattle because they have that kind of consumer base. And so it's not so easy for them to just pull out and go where, you know. Some businesses will move, no doubt, which is why we are always tirelessly pointing out that winning 15 will not be enough. Ultimately, we want to challenge the system itself. But as far as the near future is concerned, we know all these threats haven't been made before, and none of them has been been shown to be true. Another threat they make is there's going to be hyperinflation, but again, as an economist, I can tell you that's not going to happen. Prices may go up a little bit, but in reality, variables like unemployment rate and inflation rate are really determined by larger macroeconomic forces, not increases in municipal minimum wages. And people are starting to see through that, and at the end of the day, business has no choice but to accept it. But what they have done is successfully get a lot of corporate loopholes in the demand. So it's,
such
you know,
as?
A phase-in for big businesses like McDonald's, who are completely capable of paying $15 today, such as a temporary tip credit, such as a temporary healthcare credit. So what is the overall balance sheet of $15 an hour in, you know, of the struggle in Seattle? First of all, it's a phenomenal and historic victory for the working class. And it happened because we pushed for it, because 15 Now grassroots campaign was pushing for it, because the labor movement and community activists, you know, really engaged in a vibrant campaign that transformed the city. 100,000 workers will be lifted out of poverty when this is passed on Monday. You know, not overnight, obviously, but over a period of you know, 9 to 10 years. And over that period, there will be nearly $3 billion transferred from the hands of the wealthy into the hands of the bottom-most workers. That is a huge victory, and the left should not only celebrate this, but recognize in this the potential for future and bigger victories. And the fact that businesses were able to push for their loopholes and successfully get the other politicians, the rest of the city council, to shill for them, what does that show? That shows that the outcomes depend on the balance of forces, and we have to continue building this movement stronger so that the next city that pushes for 15 is able to reject those loopholes.
Well, what's interesting, I think, too, is that in the end, this is going to be a win for the right, too, if you want to, or the business, if you want to put business in the right column, because I think won't it revive the economy because there'll be more people with spending power, with greater spending power?
Absolutely. Consumer spending ability, the enhancement of consumer spending ability has been an argument that has been used by people who are not socialists but who are supporting the $15 increase, and that will be true. And that is why it is important that we don't base our analysis of $15 an hour in Keynesian arguments, although, you know, there's truth to that. But we have to, it's our job as socialists to be constantly making it clear that at the end of the day, this will not be enough, and the capitalist system will perpetually, you know, be in this cycle where we will be fighting for our rights. We will win some gains. Every gain, however small, will have to be hard fought for, and those gains will be taken away from us over time. And there is another recession waiting for us around the corner because that's the system, and that's why we have to use these movements as a springboard for more fundamental questions of system change.
I just had a last question for you, and that is, I'm sure there are no shortages of Republicans or Democrats, establishment politicians who would like to see you defeated when you're up for re-election a year from now in 2015. So what are you doing to prepare for that, and what kind of movement building are you and your organization doing to make sure you're not just a flash in the pan, something, you know, for the history books, but something that's going to move further on?
That's a very important question, and you're absolutely correct. If the political establishment and the business establishment are intelligent, then they will attempt ferociously to de-install us from city council, and they would like nothing better than to demonstrate that this was just a flash in the pan. Nothing's changed. Folks, go home. Leave it to the, you know, leave it to your local Democratic bureaucrat to, you know, run things as usual. So obviously, you know, the success of the 15 Now campaign and what we've demonstrated that, you know, what can be done through just having one socialist working class voice on city council is itself, you know, an ongoing process to show people that this is why we need not only to get this socialist reelected, but also to have more working class voices, working class advocates in government. And after we finish most of the, you know, urgent work on the 15 Now campaign, we're already turning our sights to the questions of transit and funding for transit, and the question of progressive taxation and taxing the rich, and the question of housing justice. So already, actually, alongside a left-leaning council member in City Hall, I've announced a transit proposal to save to avert some major cuts that are going to happen to the bus service in Seattle by proposing a tax on corporations and an increase in the commercial parking tax, again, which is another tax on corporations, and that has already angered the business establishment. But it has, again, it's now going to be the next pole of attraction for young activists to center around, because people are very passionate about transit. It affects low-income people and people on fixed incomes and the disabled. And we're showing through just our our day-to-day work how committed we are to our unambiguous loyalty to the working class, and how there's been a sea change just by having one voice, and how we need more. And the other thing we're doing is we're running a candidate, Jess Speer, for the Washington State House of Representatives. She's going to be running against the same person we ran against in 2012 and got 30% of the vote.
That's you.
That was me. Yeah. And that was our first election campaign in a socialist alternative. He is the most powerful Democrat in the state of Washington. And in our last campaign against him, we got 30% of the vote, which is more than double the votes that any of his opponents had ever got in his entire career. So we have already shown what we are capable of. And, you know, I also ran last year with the pledge of taking only the average worker's wage. We have lived up to that pledge. And so what people are seeing is that this is a genuine voice for working people. This is not a career politician. This is not somebody who can be corrupted. And it's not somebody who's running merely on good intentions, but on the basis of this political force, Socialist Alternative, which is as an organization rooted in the working class and committed to advancing the interests of the working class. That is what will ensure that we can build upon the success.
Thank you so much, Shama Sawant. Appreciate it.
Thank you
best
so
of luck to you and your good
thank
work
you.
In Seattle.